good idea. What else? If you think about the theme or what goes on in that book, what do you think of? Adultery of Israel, adultery. Not only the adultery of Israel, but the adultery as demonstrated in whom? His wife Gomer, right? And he did, and Harold points out that just the job that Hosea faced in a nation and preaching and teaching to a nation that was completely consumed with adultery and whose hearts had been totally given over to it to the point that they were really almost beyond reach. We'll talk about that as we go on. Let's think about the book. Steve sent me his charts, and for some reason on my computer, my version of PowerPoint, it was extending the text of that quote there from Hosea 1 and verse 2 off the page, so I modified it, so now I'm back here and it's too small. So anyway, go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. Remember, he even had children by her. First child, it says, she bore him a son. The next two, it does not actually say that. It's very possible that some of the children that he had were not even his biologically because of her adultery. You imagine being put in that situation, and I'm not faulting God. The point I'm making is the extent to which God is going to try to reach these people, to wake them up, to try to get them to change, to try to get them to listen. He's actually having one of his prophets marry a harlot, a prostitute, and have children by her in a demonstration of what God is doing or what Israel is doing to God. He's trying to wake them up. Even though he loved them, and we'll talk about that a little bit in chapter 11 today, even though he had great love for them, they are not loving him back. Well, let's think about the book and just how it's, and I have a hard time seeing that back there, but I can look back here and see it. If you broke the book up, the first couple of three chapters has to do with what we just talked about, Hosea's adulterous wife, and that God told him to go take that wife. Well, very obviously, and you don't have to be a person capable of writing a commentary to know that God is demonstrating through Hosea what Israel is doing to him, spiritual adultery. Well, he restores his wife, just as God would restore Israel. That's really the first part of the book. And the part that we're in right now, it's been described as prophetic discourses on an adulterous Israel and her faithful God. We've been looking at chapters 4 through 8. Israel's sins were detailed. Now we're going to really start focusing more on the punishment, even though we're kind of seeing aspects of that already. And even hopefully we'll get to Wednesday night, the response that God has in chapters 12 through 13. And then at the very end, Israel's restoration will be decreed. But there'll be an aspect to that that will be a prophetic future type of restoration that we are demonstrating today. About what time, do you recall about what time and who was reigning when Hosea began? This had been in the days of Jeroboam II. The timing is somewhere around 750 or 760 B.C. up to 725 B.C. So there are several kings there. And this is getting towards the latter end. When did Samaria fall? 722 or 721, depending on what source you consult. So if he's preaching somewhere around 750 to 725 and Israel or Samaria falls in 722 or 721, this is getting close to the time. I mean, God is pulling out all the stops here to try to get their attention. Try to get their attention. So we're very close. I've also read, as I understand it, How would things be from a materialistic, economic point of view in Israel? From what I can read, it was pretty good right now. You know, Jeroboam reigned, I think, something like 40-something years. And the kingdom had expanded. Things were pretty good from a material standpoint. And the people of Israel, what were they attributing their successes to? Idols. Idols. And they had been influenced by people around them to worship idols. What else would have been associated with idol worship? From a perversion standpoint, sexual perversion. That would have been very much a part of that. So you can kind of see how people might be drawn into that. You know, they're serving these idols. Things are going well from a material standpoint. They're engaging in the carnal pleasures that people will be involved in. I don't want to get too specific, but it was a very perverse time. And so you can see how people, if they're not grounded in what the Bible says and what God was saying to them and biblical principles, you can see how easy it would be for them to get caught up in that. And I think Steve's already made some allusions to our day and age. You know, we're in the most prosperous country in the world, and we're seeing more and more perverseness being accepted. And people don't think God's paying attention. They don't even believe that there is a God, or if they believe there's a God, they don't believe in the Bible. They shut their hearts off to it, even if they know what it says. And we're kind of going down the same path. I don't know if we've reached at least not most places in our country have reached the point that these people would have reached. But we're on that path. It may take a few generations, but we're on that path. Well, I think we finished chapter 8 last Wednesday night. So turn over to chapter 9. We'll begin at the very first of the chapter. We'll do some reading. And I'm not going to pretend to be able to explain with exact accuracy everything that is said here. I think there's a lot of questions about some passages, about what some passages mean. But I think we can get the overall point. And even if we don't know the specifics of every phrase or every detail, the point is very obvious. He tells them, "Do not rejoice, O Israel. Don't exult like the prophet, like the peoples." What do you think he's referring to when he says the peoples? I think he's probably talking about the nations around them. And I'm reading from the English Standard Version. "You have played the whore, forsaking your God. You have loved a prostitute's wages on all threshing floors. Threshing floor and vine and wine vat shall not feed them, and the wine, new wine shall fail them. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord." So you've been spiritual prostitutes. What's the purpose of a threshing floor? All right, it was a way of separating grain such that you could use it for food. And these places would have been built. I've read a lot of them would have been placed on higher up elevations to take advantage of wind and whatnot. And these places became, not only did they become a place to which to do what they were intended for, they were became a place of idol worship as well. And what he's saying here is, the threshing floor and the wine vat shall not feed them. This is going to fail. Your prosperity is going to fail. A lot of commentators believe that, at least the ones that I read, when he tells them, "Don't rejoice, O Israel, don't exult like the people," he would have referred to some of their festivals. And a lot of their festivals would have involved licentiousness and sexual perversion. And in their worship to Baal and fertility gods like that, they would have attributed the worship of that god and the things that were involved in that worship to receiving material benefits. Right? Good crops, things like that. And what he's saying is, don't rejoice in this, because this is going to fail. New wine shall fail them. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord. But Ephraim shall return to Egypt. If you were a Jew and you heard the term Egypt and you knew anything about the history of the Jewish people, what did you think? What would you think of when you thought of Egypt? Huh? Bondage, slavery. Exactly. I think that's probably what he had in mind here. Ephraim shall return to Egypt. They shall eat unclean food in Assyria. There's a way that, and I don't know much about Hebrew at all, but from what I have read of people that do, the way the Hebrew language would sometimes emphasize a point, it would be called parallelism. And what he's saying here, that the thought here is the same. Ephraim shall return to Egypt. They shall eat unclean food in Assyria. It's sort of a double way of making the same point. I did not believe, and most commentators don't believe, that they would have literally been taken back to Egypt, but Egypt is used as a means of conveying the idea of slavery. You're going to return to slavery. You're going to eat unclean food in Assyria. And we know that's exactly what happened. What did we say beginning the class? We're 3 or 4 years away from the Assyrians coming. Samaria falls. So you think about it. Being that close from a prosperous nation to one that has been overrun and your capital falls to the Assyrians. And why is it happening? Spiritual adultery. Unfaithfulness to God. Verse 4, they shall not pour out offerings of wine to the Lord. Their sacrifices shall not please them. It shall be like mourner's bread to them. Who eat of it, all who eat of it shall be defiled. A person who would have been mourning at that time frame and been in contact with a dead body would have been considered unclean. So anything that they ate would have been during a time of uncleanness. And I think that may be what's being talked about. You're not going to participate in your spiritual worship anymore. When they're taken and gone to Assyria, they're not going to have an opportunity to worship like they're intended to worship. That time is going to be gone. I'm doing a lot of talking, so if anybody has a point, just speak up or raise your hand. The point is made that a lot of things that are going on now, Mr. Stevens made, that we're seeing, that parallel this. What does the New Testament say about idolatry? What does it equate idolatry to? Covetousness. Covetousness. When you think of covetousness, what do you think of? I hear whispering, but I can't hear what you're saying. I'm getting older, and I can't hear as well as I used to. I think that's part of the problem. Okay, greed. Greed. Greed for perhaps material things. Greed for political power. And our nation's kind of become that. It's driven by greed and prosperity. People and companies are endorsing things that 50 years ago they wouldn't have dreamed of endorsing for greed. Political power. Both sides just trying to beat the other one down. Covetousness. And our country is driven by it. And I fear for our country. We're on a dangerous path. I don't think we've reached the point that these people have, but we're on this. We're traveling that same road. I don't think we do either. And we have to be careful that we don't get caught up in that as well. Let's make sure that our greed doesn't drive us, because it can. And if we're more interested and we're doing more in our daily lives, in the pursuit of material things, than we are in our service to God, then we're on a dangerous path. So let's go back to the text here. Behold, they are going away from destruction, but Egypt shall gather them. Memphis shall bury them. Again, there's this parallelism thought. And it's possible that some people might have fled when this invasion comes. Some of the people might have actually fled to Egypt. Memphis was known as I didn't know this until I read it, that Memphis had the largest cemetery in Egypt was in Memphis. So there would have been an association with burying that would have kind of triggered the thought there. Nettles shall possess their precious things of silver. Thorns shall be in their tent. That is, your treasures and your homes, you're not going to need them. You're not going to use them. They're not going to do you any good. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel shall know it. Turn over to 2 Kings, the 5th chapter. 2 Kings, the 7th chapter. Oscar, how about reading verses 5 through 12? 2 Kings 7, verses 5 through 12. So hold on a second. Are you in 2 Kings or 1 Kings? 2 Kings 7? Okay, I get the wrong passage here. So let me read. I'm sorry, Oscar. I guess I put the wrong thing down here. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. Maybe somebody can tell me where I am here. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. For it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And I want you to listen particularly what's said here. And they had feared other gods and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. Also the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. There they burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. They did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger, for they served idols, of which the Lord had said, "You shall not do this thing." God had made it clear they were not to participate in it. Anybody ever figure out where I... 17. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that, Oscar. So God is saying here, once this happened, God is attributing this to the things the people were doing. But they had reached a point by Hosea's time, they had shut their hearts and minds off to it. They didn't care what God said. And I think of people that I know who are Christians or were Christians who will no longer allow anything to reach them. They shut their minds off to it. Look at verse 7. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows. And I believe he's speaking of their prophets here. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is insane because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. We may think, because things have gone well in our country, and we're the most powerful nation in the world, supposedly, that God's not paying any attention. I think a lot of people don't either. If they believe in any God at all, they don't think God is really active at all in our nation and really cares. And they're making a huge mistake if they think that. Tremendous mistake. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare. I think he's drawing a contrast here. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet, he's speaking of their prophet, is a fowler's snare in all his ways. Enmity in the house of his God. They are deeply corrupted. This is verse 9. As in the days of Gibeah, who will remember their iniquity? He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. What do you think of when you think of Gibeah? And there are several different things that might come to mind, actually. Do you remember a Levite with a concubine? Remember that story? He had a concubine who was unfaithful to him, and he had gone and brought her back, and he decided he was traveling, and her father kept trying to say, "Hey, stay the night. And he did a couple of nights, and finally he says, "All right, I'm going." And I think it was about nighttime when he left. And he's traveling, and he decides to lodge he's invited to lodge, I believe it is. And I may have my story mixed up a little bit. And the men of the city of Gibeah surrounded the place and told the owner, bring out the man. Bring the man out to us. And again, this would have involved homosexual rape. And instead, the Levite's concubine is sent out. And not to say that that was the right thing to do, but that happened. And they abused her. The men of Gibeah abused her. What did the Levite do with her after she had ultimately died? All right, well said. Cut her in pieces, sent her body parts throughout the land to just demonstrate the abomination that occurred. And what was the reaction on the part of the other nation, other tribes? Nothing had ever been seen, and Gibeah was attacked, was it not? And they were attacked, almost wiped out. And there had to be a mechanism for what remained to have wives because of a vow that was made. The point that is made here is that what they are doing is on the level of the wickedness that occurred at Gibeah. I think that's his point. But here's a contrast, verse 10. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruits on the fig tree in the first season. He may have been thinking as far back as when God appeared to Abraham, or maybe even prior to that, that God envisioned this little nation that he took for his own, like grapes in the wilderness, like the first fruits on the fig tree in its first season, attractive to God. But they went to Baal Peor. You remember what happened there? They separated themselves to that shame. They became an abomination like the thing that they loved. I believe this is a reference to Balaam and Balak. Balak, the king of Moab, what was he wanting to do with the Israelites? He wanted to see them cursed, right? And because he feared them, he wanted to see, when he called in Balaam, who was some sort of seer of some sort, he felt like he had the ability to pronounce some sort of curse, so he called them in. Balaam wouldn't do it, would he? I can only speak what God tells me to say, but what did he counsel Balak to do? I'm sorry? Well, and there was another thing too. Yeah, worship their gods, but there was they brought women into them, and the men of Israel committed adultery with those women, sexual sin with those women. And that was kind of the way he got them cursed, in a sense. And again, he's bringing this back to big historical events that occurred in Israel's day, things that they should have been ashamed of, things that were a terrible thing, obviously, to God. And he's equating that to how they are behaving now. I have a hard time covering three chapters today. Verse 11, as for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. If you look at verses 11 through 14, I think you see a similar theme. It is dealing with, and I'm not even looking at these charts, they'll have no posterity, no descendants to speak of. They're about to be taken away, assimilated into another nation and another culture. They're not going to be a nation anymore. And if they have children, Ephraim will bring his children out to the murderer. What will you give? A miscarrying womb? One that can't nurse? You know, there's not going to be any children to have to, that's going to benefit them. Verses 11 through 14, I think, is addressing the kind of idea that really, it's kind of a, they're not going to be any future generations. Look at verse 15 now. All their wickedness is in Gilgal. Remember Gilgal? There's something that, there are three past events that are listed here, and there's some question as to exactly what is meant, what specific event is meant. I'll suggest something here in a second. There I hated them because of the evil of their deeds. I will drive them from my house. I will love them no more. Their princes are rebellious. When the people, after the days of Samuel, what did the people ask for? We want to be like the other nations. They got a king. Why can't we have a king? Well, who was their king? God was their king. So in asking for another king, what were they ultimately doing? Rejecting the king that they had. They were rejecting God, exactly. Well, Saul was made king at Gilgal. And not only was that the case, Gilgal was the place that Saul had been told to wait until Samuel arrived for a sacrifice to be made. What did Saul do instead when Samuel delayed? Yeah, he went ahead and offered it himself. Again, and this was, he would have been defying the word of the prophet. The prophet spoke for God. He was rejecting God. So we see three or more different things that are referenced that should have woke them up and said, you're being like they were back then. They should have known that story. Maybe they didn't. Hosea's already said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yes, were they to bear children, I would kill the darlings of their womb. My God will cast them away because they did not obey Him, and they shall be wanderers among the nation. There's a little bit of a play here on words. The term Ephraim meant fruitful. And what he's saying here is, and Ephraim is being used representatively of Israel, I believe. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. The very term that meant fruitful, they're not going to have any fruit because they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't hear it. Any comment on chapter 9? All right, let's move on to chapter 10. This sort of transitions to the idea, okay, destruction is now coming. Israel empties his vine. He brings forth fruit for himself according to the multitude of his fruit. He has increased the altars according to the bounty of his land. They embellished his sacred pillars. Again, does this sound like this is a time of famine or a time of prosperity? Based on verse 1. He has increased the altars according to the bounty of his land. He brings forth fruit for himself. He empties his vine. And I realize there are differences in translations here. I think the idea here is that they have been pretty successful material-wise. They gain material successes on the basis of their participation in idolatry, or at least they attributed it to that, and it was based on selfishness, excess, idolatry, sexual perversion. All were a part of what they were doing. Things were going pretty well for them. Look at verses 2 and 3. And I'm not going to hit every thought here because I don't have a good explanation for some of these things. But God, it says that God will break down their altars. He will ruin their sacred pillars. For now they say, we have no king because we did not fear the Lord. As for a king, what would he do for us? They have spoken words, verse 4, swearing falsely and making a covenant. The idea here of making a covenant, your word should be, you should live up to your word, is what he's saying. They weren't doing that. Thus judgment springs up like hemlock in the furrows of the field. What is hemlock? Poison, and I think that's the idea here. It's a tree that can be made into a poison, and I think that's the point. Poison. Hemlock, or some of your versions may say wormwood, was something that was mentioned also in Deuteronomy as a result of idolatry. So God has already told them this hundreds of years before. Verse 5, the inhabitants of Samaria fear because of the calf of Beth-Aven. For its people mourn for it, for its priests shriek for it, because its glory has departed from it. I think now he's saying, well, when you think of calves, in terms of Israel history, what comes to mind? Images, where were they? The calves. Well, okay, there's more than one occasion, but I'm thinking of what Jeroboam set up. Dan and Bethel, one end of Israel and the other end of Israel. And these became a place of worship. And the inhabitants of, and from my understanding here, he is kind of changing. It is thought that this is a reference to Bethel, but sort of a changing of the terms. Bethel meant what? House of God. Well, Beth Avon, and I didn't know this, maybe some of you know this, meant house of vanity, house of emptiness. And it is believed here that he's referencing that golden calf there at Bethel, but he's calling it something else now. House of God is now house of emptiness, house of vanity. And the people are mourning for it. It's pre-shriek for it. They had become so attached to this that they mourn for it. The idol shall be carried to Assyria as a present for King Jerob. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel. It's going to end. As for Samaria, her king is cut off like the twig on the water. The high places of Avon, again, emptiness, the sin of Israel shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow on their altars. They shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Now, this is, of course, specifically mentioning the fall of Samaria, but what is that language also used to maybe, what was used later on to another fall of Jerusalem later on, when those words used by Jesus to reference the destruction of Jerusalem that was coming. So he used that language as well. This was a big cataclysmic event in terms of a nation that's going to fall. You remember the pictures that Steve showed of, and I think it was of believed to be the site of the golden calves. I believe it was at the northern part. I don't remember exactly which one it was. It was either Dan or Bethel. But he showed some pictures of that, and it's just abandoned and overgrown, and it's not used anymore. O Israel, you have sinned from the days of Gibeah. There they stood. The battle in Gibeah against the children of iniquity did not overtake them. Gibeon again is used as a reminder of how long Israel had persisted in this kind of sin, all the way back. And again, it's recall the wickedness that occurred in Gibeah, that occurred to the Levite's concubine. When it is my desire, I will chasten them. People shall be gathered against them when I bind for them for their two transgressions. Assyria is going to come. But Ephraim is like a trained heifer that loves to thresh grain. You would have a heifer, and they would be used to work, to make a furrow, I guess, or to plow with. And what did it say about an ox that was used in that kind of work? What were you to allow the ox to do while it was working? Yeah, don't put a muzzle on it so it can't eat. It's working. It ought to benefit from the work that it's doing, right? And that language is used later on by Paul in references to making sure that preachers can benefit financially from working as preachers. But in this context, he's saying, well, Ephraim's like a trained heifer that loves to thresh grain. If you're an animal doing that, you'd like to eat, right? Well, I harnessed her fair neck. I will make Ephraim pull a plow. Ephraim shall plow. Jacob shall break his clods. Judah shall plow. So he's bringing now the nation of Judah. So what he's saying is both sides are going to be harnessed, both the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom as well. It had been easy for Israel. It's not going to be later on. But verse 10, as deep and as far into idolatry as they were, God is still going to encourage them to repent. Sow for yourselves righteousness Reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord. He comes and rains righteousness on you. You have plowed wickedness, you have reaped iniquity, you have eaten the fruit of lies, because you have trusted in your own way and the multitude of your mighty men. This is the same idea of plowing continuing here. Therefore the tumult shall arise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be plundered. As Shalman plundered Beth Arbel in the day of battle, really not known for sure. They believe that's a reference to Shalmaneser, but the specific battle is not known now. A mother dashed in pieces upon her children. It shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off. Judgment was coming. Does some of this almost sound over the top? It just continues. But they had become bored of it, where it wasn't going to reach them anymore. What else could God do? You know, He sent prophets. He's tried to warn them. You think of someone who's gone astray, and you think, what can be said to that person to wake them up, to open up their heart again? And you don't give up, do you? And you keep bringing up things to them. And you keep trying to encourage them. And you keep praying for them. I read that he's going to be treated like any other. You know, they're going to come in, and maybe the invasion would occur at dawn, and I'm speaking off the top of my head now, but the thing that I read was intended by that is he ain't going to be any different than anybody else. You would think an invasion occurs early, and the easiest parts are going to be taken right off the bat. The easy prey will fall, or the low-hanging fruit, sometimes we call it. It would probably be harder to get to the king, yet he would be more protected, and it would take longer in the day or days to reach him. But it's saying he's going to be taken in the dawn. He's not going to be any different. And by saying over the top, I did not intend to be critical of God. What I'm trying to say is, God is pulling out every measure possible to try to reach these people to wake them up. Did it happen? Did it work? No. Israel fell. And today, people who reject God and turn their hearts and mind away from them. Well, we got through two chapters. We will pick up on chapter 11. I was hoping to get through 14 through the end of the book, but that may be hard to do. Anyway, thank you for your comments.